Hello and welcome to the Aldi podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Aldi's editorial assistant. This week, our guest is the author, historian and co-founder of the Society for Court Studies, Philip Mansell. He will tell us about his latest book, a biography of Louis XIV of France, the Sun King. So Philip, welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Jumping straight in, what was it about Louis that you found so interesting?
It was how the whole machine of Versailles and the monarchy worked, and the relations. The most interesting thing of all is the diplomatic game of France and the different states of Europe, Poland, England, Spain, how everything related to each other. It was like a very elaborate piece of clockwork. Every bit of machinery fits into the other and keeps the other working.
Okay, and so, and you've, of course, you have this history with the court, the Society of Court Studies. And we were having a quick chat beforehand, and you were saying about what took your interest in terms of court life. What is it about Louis' court life that is so intriguing?
It's the way personalities and personal emotions are institutionalised, with the royal family at the heart of it, the king's relations with his son, his wife, his mother, his brother are very, very important. You're meant to feel loyalty to the monarch, but that's just a facade underneath. Each is out for their own, they're out to feather their nests and advance their careers. And in fact, it's the interface between personal feelings and public events, which is all on the parquet floors of Versailles.
Sure. But it was also considered to be a great way of neutralising his slightly more dangerous neighbours.
Yes, but I think that's maybe slightly exaggerated. It was also just a vast job centre, everybody coming in and out. They weren't there all the year, all the time at Versailles. They were also running regiments, governing provinces, looking after their estates, or indeed enjoying themselves in Paris. The king's brother had a palace in Paris. The king's adored son, the Dauphin, went to the opera every night in Paris and was adored in Paris.
Mm-hmm. But just to sort of run back to the beginning of it all, how did his reign begin? He inherited a bit of a mess, didn't he?
Yes, it's got a rebellion called the Fronde, which would have been much more extreme if the French hadn't looked at the English Civil War and the execution of Charles I and drawn back in horror, saying anything but follow the English example. And in fact, it was a vast attempt to have a constitutional monarchy with controls on the monarch and a lot more freedom for cities like Bordeaux and Marseille, and it almost succeeded. It was touch and go for 4 years between 1648 and 1652. Sometimes the king was under the military control of his rebellious subjects.
So at what point was that?
When he was still young, about 12 to 14.
12 to 14.
But in fact, it blew itself out. It was also a tax revolt because taxes were so high to pay for a war with Spain. Mm. And it was a revolt against a very unpopular chief minister called Mazarin, or rather Mazarini. He was an Italian.
So that was still a good 10 or so years before Mazarin died. So, I mean, they had to put up with quite a lot. And is Louis' removal of Mazarin altogether, was that a populist move, as it were? Was it sort of trying to find favour?
Well, he only briefly removed Mazarin during the Fronde. In fact, he adored him. He was the father who had died. He replaced Louis XIII, who had died when Louis was only 5. And they got on very well, and Mazarin sort of groomed him in statesmanship and diplomacy and the art of silence and dissembling.
A really interesting line I came across in sort of doing a bit of research for this, something said by Saint-Simon, a fairly sort of high-ranking member of his court at Versailles. He described Louis' reign as being the reign of the vile bourgeoisie.
Yes.
Why?
I think that's very exaggerated. It's Saint-Simon's bitterness because he didn't himself have office. He wasn't really influential or in power. Some of the king's ministers had fairly distant bourgeois origins. They weren't really bourgeois. They all bought estates which gave them nobility. Really, it's a code for saying Saint-Simon and his friends, his very grand ducal friends, were not in power. But in fact, a lot of dukes did hold high office. It's very exaggerated.
But they were sort of that noblesse de la robe, that sort of the administrative aristocracy, as it were. They were.
Yes.
I thought that was pioneered by him, though, wasn't it? I mean, or is
no,
that...
it had begun. It was more powerful under his father. It's a very interesting group, like the sort of mandarins who ran the British civil service, and they were very important. They supplied a lot of ministers.
Mm. You mentioned England briefly. What I mean, you said in the past, throughout his reign, he did a lot of things which were very formative for Britain and for France. Yes. throughout the whole 18th century, really. Is that fair?
Yes, it's a period of two vast world wars: the War of the League of Augsburg, 1689 to 97, and the War of the Spanish Succession, 1702 to 1712. Britain and France are grappling for influence in Europe and colonies abroad, and in effect, it's a draw. But London does overtake Paris as a commercial centre. Its population, for the first time ever, is larger than Paris, and it's always been larger since. The French Protestants, who Louis has persecuted, and they've fled, they help found the Bank of England, make London a boom city, and it helps expand the British Navy, the Bank of England, the British Army. But at the same time, there were periods of peace and alliance. Two nations issued from the same blood. He's referring to the Norman conquest and the massive French immigration into England then. And there were great periods of peace, and the English adored Versailles. They flocked to Versailles. They wrote admiring books about Versailles. Lord Chesterfield said, "An hour in Versailles was worth more than 3 hours in a study with the best books." So there was a lot of interaction and mutual influencing between France and England.
And what was the relationship with his cousins, of course, with James II, Charles II?
That's incredibly important. They'd known each other as children when the Stuarts were in exile during the Civil War. They knew each other well. They danced in the same elaborate court ballets. And then 1688, James flees England. He's become unpopular, partly because of Louis' persecution of Protestants in France. So the English say to each other, "Look what a Catholic monarch can do to Protestants." And Louis receives him with open arms. He has quite a grand court at another palace near Versailles called Saint-Germain, where the Jacobites stay for about 40 years. He has his own army, his own law courts, his own herald. And they see each other the whole time. Every week, practically, there are visits between the two families. But it was a disaster for France, because the Stuarts were more or less a lost cause in England. And it was also a disaster for the Stuarts, because being seen as French protégés sort of killed their chances with English public opinion.
Mm. And could you shed a bit of light on the Treaty of Dover, or the secret Treaty of Dover?
It's very interesting. That's when he tried to woo the British ambassadors, if he was a mistress. It was a plan, a joint plan. They were both fed up with Dutch commercial superiority and envious of it. They planned a joint attack on Holland, England with the navy, France with the army, which almost took Amsterdam in 1672. The secret Treaty of Dover prepared this, and Charles II said he would declare himself a Catholic and remove the anti-Catholic laws in England. But that may just have been a sort of gambit in his diplomacy, because he may have been a secret Catholic, but he's pretty Protestant in England, and he brought up his nieces, his heirs, Mary and Anne, as Protestants. And he later welcomed French Protestants persecuted by Louis. So the secret Treaty of Dover launched this attack, but in fact the Dutch resisted and the attack failed.
Mm, another interesting aspect of his sort of wars with the Dutch is, I mean, as I understand it, he effectively broke them as a power in many ways after him, but he did put William III of Orange effectively, William of Orange effectively made him King of England almost in his sort of
by reaction. Well,
yes, indeed. Sorry,
It encouraged William. William became King of England not for the sake of England, but for the sake of Europe, so he could form European alliances backed by the power and wealth of England to limit Louis's power and expansion. Mm. And Louis was nibbling away at the southern Netherlands, the Rhineland, Germany, and Amsterdam was terrified. And also, Louis's particular tactical blunders helped William become king, because as William was sailing across the Channel, a very daring amphibious exercise with 15,000 men, 400 ships, Louis, instead of trying to stop the invasion or attacking the Netherlands, he was attacking Germany. Louis, in a way, as you say, is an architect of William's supremacy.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned his sort of, shall we say, aggressive foreign policy. But his expansionism was sort of pretty much everywhere. I mean, they didn't last too long, his attempts at expansion in Europe. They tended to more or less end the same. French borders didn't differ too much.
No, he did get three great provinces, French Flanders, Alsace and Franche-Comté. So if Lille, Strasbourg and Besançon are French now, it's basically due to Louis.
Oh, I see.
And he also took great care. He's not stuck in Versailles or Paris. He's always visiting these provinces. And five times he went to Dunkirk, which is a hell of a journey now, let alone then. And, of course, all these forts he's building everywhere, some of which were still being used in the Second World War.
I mean, yeah, he was very aware of that border of France, though. So the other sort of element of his expansionism, of course, was his overseas expansion. So west and east, I mean, and Africa also, I mean, pretty much everywhere. That was quite...
Yes, and he was really global, in many ways far more global than today's leaders like Trump or Johnson. He was always talking to travellers during his public lunch, asking them to write books, allowing them to dedicate their books to him. He knew what was going on in Siam or China or the court of the Mughal Emperor in India. He founded colonies in Africa, in India, in America. He grabbed the entire valley of the Mississippi for France. That's why Louisiana is called Louisiana after him. And in fact, tragically, the French slave trade began under him from Nantes to the coast of Africa. He had some Africans came to Versailles, some Native Americans. A Chinese convert to Catholicism came and showed him how to use chopsticks. So it was really a global hub, Versailles. Mm. More in some ways than the White House today.
Sure. And so what brought him... What was the source of his interest in someone like Siam? I mean, I know he sort of sent missionaries there. Was it sort of principally a pious Catholic thing, or was it something more more political?
On the surface, it was pious Catholic. He paid for missionaries to go there. He wrote letters to the King of Siam saying he should convert to Catholicism because it was the true religion and because it was a religion that taught subjects to obey their monarchs. But underneath, there's French expansionism. He thought anything was possible in the 1680s. He wanted to grab land and territory. People told him he was destined to rule the earth. He had globes in his palace at Marly, and he sent troops to Bangkok to try and take over Siam, but they were defeated. Mm. And he sent missionaries to China and corresponded with the emperor. He and received beautiful blue and white Chinese porcelain, and very nearly the Chinese emperor converted to Catholicism. Thanks to French Jesuits.
Mm-hmm. But was that principally, I thought that was to undermine the Portuguese influence, was that?
It's also, of course, always competing with other European powers to undermine the Portuguese influence, to undermine Dutch influence in Siam. He took Louisiana to stop the English getting it. They're always playing this great game of diplomacy, power, global trade, very keen on government sponsorship of French trading companies. And in fact, at the end of his reign, when finally peace breaks out at Utrecht in 1713, his secretary writes a rather wonderful manifesto for Europe. All the states of which Europe is composed have between them necessary liaisons and connections, which means that one can regard them as members of one same republic. And it is impossible for a change to take place in any of its members without it troubling the repose of all the others. And they thought of England as an essential part of the European dance, as they called it.
Well, I'm intrigued by that kind of whole, that's a very broad stroke, that extreme expansionism. Is that sort of something which, when you take in context his comment of l'état c'est moi, the state is me, or I am the state rather, is that... One gets the underlying sense that that's more than just France's interest. It's a case of personal prestige. Was that the aim behind something like his idea of Europe? Or was that something else?
I don't think he said, l'état c'est moi, because as he's dying, he said, I am dying, but the state will go on. He's very conscious of the state as something independent of the biological figure of the king. But he's also obsessed with immortality and fame. And he identifies himself with France. There's a very strong sense of nationality, of French expansion, but also there's him. He wants to be the new Alexander the Great, remembered forever. And that's one reason for building Versailles. It's going to be the best, most modern, largest palace in Europe, which will ensure his fame forever. And in a way, he has the last laugh, because it does. It's the most visited palace in the world after the Forbidden City in Peking. And it's also, it's packed with people and packed with events. Every evening there's a concert, an opera, a party, a business show for French products. It really is alive again.
Mm. So he, as you say, he maintains that, he put a huge amount of effort into creating an image of himself, of France, associating the two. But just on a sort of mild side note, how did he become the Sun King, specifically?
1662 has a glamorous tournament
right
in Paris. The Place du Carrousel is called after his carousel, where he and 600 knights do rituals on horseback
right
to music. So it's dance, horse dancing to music. Very grand, everybody tilting and tournaments. And at that tournament, he takes as his personal emblem the sun. And he regards himself as the sun, as monarchs always had. Mm-hmm. And Apollo is the sun god, and he's also the god of the arts. Mm-hmm. And Louis is, in my opinion, the most universal patron of the arts has ever been. He loved painting and music and ballet and gardens and architecture and sculpture. And he talked to the creators as an equal. He invited his great gardener, Le Nôtre, to go round Versailles with him in a similar wheelchair as an equal of the King of France. And so he chooses the sun because it's universal, it shines everywhere, and it's beneficial.
I see.
Or before global warming.
The world doesn't. The world doesn't live without. But yeah, was it the, what's the other line someone's had? The king that the sun never set on, or something like that.
Yes.
But on the note of artists and playwrights, Madame de Maintenon, she was the widow of one of his playwrights. Is that right?
That's right. She was the widow of a rather unrespectable, rebellious, strange playwright called Paul Scarron,
sure,
who was quite famous and whose works Louis read as a boy. In fact, they were performed even in old age in front of Madame de Maintenon, the widow of the playwright.
And how important was she to him? She was
she was very important. He loved the company of women. He really was a woman's man. And in his reign in 1674, a treatise on the equality between the sexes and the necessity of destroying prejudices was published in Paris with his special approval, because it's got the entwined double L's on the title page. And she was an advisor, and also this, she was his Dominic Cumming squared or cubed. And she's really there, and people go through her to get to the king. They write him her letters, including his own members of his own family, telling her things more directly than they would have dared to the king.
Mm.
And she's very, very important.
Mm.
But she had many faults. Reading her letters is quite an ordeal because they're always depressing. She's never cheerful, always gloomy, but she wanted peace. And Louis loved war, and the War of the Spanish Succession went on far longer than she wanted. So that proves her influence wasn't dominant.
Mm. But was she, obviously between Colbert, who was the Louis's, if I understand, he was a cardinal, but he was also basically more or less the chief minister. Was that
no, right? He was the chief minister, he wasn't the cardinal.
I think Mazarin,
chief
sorry.
Financial minister, and Omar Tufair, with a finger in every pie, he looked after Louis's illegitimate children, he advised him on Versailles, though he was against Versailles. He said, it's unworthy of the glory of your majesty. And he focused on the Louvre, quite rightly.
Mm.
And in fact, we owe Louis XIV the Louvre and the role of the Louvre as a palace of the arts. They wanted it to be a global palace, like it's now a global museum. And artists and printmakers and furniture makers lived in the Louvre. And there were some rooms with royal collections open to the well-dressed public. But Colbert was brilliant. He balanced the books, and nothing went wrong when Colbert was alive. After his death in 1683, nothing went right, really.
I see.
Okay. In fact, the French monarchy never balanced the books between 1683 and 1789. And 1789 is because the books because of bankruptcy, really.
Yeah, yeah. But in terms of the other important people in Louis's life, you have this interesting character, Alexandre Bontemps.
Yes.
He was Louis's valet. He gets quite a lot of attention on the TV series Versailles. I don't know whether that's of any interest. But why well, you know, TV is. But what was he, sort of, this great figure, this great friend?
He's a premier valet de chambre. It's a very specifically French position. It's like head valet, or it's like an equivalent of a super butler. So he's got the keys to Versailles. He has a troop of valets under him who are watching, checking, seeing what's going on, who's with who, reporting on conversations to the king. So the king probably knew in the evening what you'd said the day before and who you'd been with. And yes, he's very, very important and trusted and adored the king, and the king adored him. And he's not a noble.
He was sort of showered with gifts. I mean, how long were they sort of, how was he in Louis's service for?
He was in Louis's service for about 40 years until his death. And then his son succeeded him. He's governor of Versailles as well as premier valet de chambre du roi.
Extraordinary. I think one of the last things I would want to just touch on is Louis's piety. He was sort of very strictly religious, fasted very sort of specifically, if I've understood correctly.
Yes. And he touched for the king's evil thousands of people every year. And taking it all very, very seriously. Lots of sermons, lots of going to mass. And it's associated with his love of music. He's the most music-loving king of France, if not European monarch there's ever been. He personally auditioned singers in the choir chapel. So the best music in Europe was at the chapel of Versailles.
Mm-hmm. Just to slightly sort of revert back to discussion of the Huguenots, when he sort of overturned the Edict of Nantes, which was, well, I think it was Henry II had given... Henry IV had sort of put in to protect their freedoms. I was interested to note that he didn't do that in Lorraine, is that correct?
In Alsace,
I'm sorry.
He just conquered, next. Yes, it shows the two sides of his personality. He could be perfectly intelligent and pragmatic, as he was, by not imposing Catholicism on the Lutherans of Alsace. It was a majority Lutheran province. But he could be viciously intolerant at the same time, and he's incredibly cruel to French Protestants, separating families, murders, rapes, burning alive outside Montpellier of people who had profaned the host. His ministers discuss exterminating all Protestants, though Louis does refuse that. But horrific persecutions, and peasants were encouraged to rob anybody found fleeing across the Alps. So it's like the 1930s, really. And that is Louis XIV. Personally, he got God badly, and I think it may be proof of the proverb, there's nobody as tiresome as a reformed rake. He had been pretty rakish in his youth. Mm-hmm. Some of his friends had been libertines, atheists, and he's repenting. And his mother, Anne of Austria, and his advisor, Cardinal Mazarin, who saw the French monarchy through the Fronde, they had many faults, but they weren't personally cruel. They were forgiving. I don't understand his cruelty. William III takes England practically without a shot being fired in anger. At the same time, Louis XIV is devastating the cities of the Rhineland, giving orders that not one stone should remain on top of another in Mannheim or Heidelberg or other places. Horrifying French generals whose letters complaining to the Minister of War are still around. It's Louis personally. He believed in a scorched earth policy. I mean, like America and Vietnam, all for nothing.
Mm-hmm. And a last sort of reversion back on the Catholic Fund. I meant to mention this earlier, but I was intrigued by his attempt at creating not quite his own church, but establishing a more secularly powerful French element in the French church,
which was part of the tradition of the French church called the Gallican Church. It had its own assemblies. It had its own tax voting powers. In fact, it may have been to please the French church at a time of conflict with the Pope that Louis revoked the Edict of Nantes. That is one explanation. Mm. Yes, he didn't like the Pope, especially if he thought the Pope was pro-Austrian.
Right.
His great dynastic rivals, the Houses of Austria, who empowered Spain and the Holy Roman Empire. But it didn't go very deep, and he's always conscious of his duty to respect the Pope.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think it's just in there as a sort of a conclusionary question, as it were. What do you think is his greatest legacy? Because, I mean, he did achieve so much.
I think it's the culture of his reign and the Palace of Versailles, the music, the plays by Racine and Molière, the Le Notre Gardens with the endless perspectives, the sculpture in the gardens, the contrast of the white marble with the green bushes, the love of luxury, of furniture, sculptures, tapestries. There's a wonderful exhibition on his tapestries at the moment. That image, which is still popular among some modern millionaires, the Louis style.
Mm.
And you can see it's still alive in France today, that President Macron sometimes holds official ceremonies or meetings of parliament in Versailles, the prestige of Versailles. He receives Putin in Versailles. I think it's that strong monarchy, which also inspired De Gaulle and elements of the Constitution of the Fifth Republic. And I've been to De Gaulle's country house, and there are two pictures of Louis XIV hanging on the walls. So it's all there. And whether it's right or wrong, but it works. It survived. I think that's his strongest legacy. And when things went really bad in 1709 to 1710, when there's climate disasters, defeat after defeat, Marlborough thinks he's going to reach Paris and force Louis to call the States General, which would have been the revolution 80 years in advance. In fact, he doesn't weaken or show fear or anything like that. He just carries on, and in the end, his troops do win. And in the end, he's saved by his troops, by Spanish troops, which are defeating English and Austrian forces, and by divisions in England. Mm. He just has to wait for England to fall apart, with the Tories far preferring to do a deal with Louis than to let the enemies, the Whigs, stay in power and reach Paris.
I can't help myself to ask this question. You mentioned sort of the whole lavishness of his reign and the legacy that had on France. Surely that lavishness is what caused the revolution, is it not?
Yes.
Was that a bit too simple? It helped cause it,
but it's not really lavishness. It's wars and bankruptcy and bad finances. Mm. I mean, there was lavishness at Blenheim Palace or other places in England, but they had better organised finances at that time and a better banking system. And it's above all he came to power, 1661, he says he's going to rule by himself, partly because he's so annoyed by his financial official, Fouquet, who gives a grand party at Vaux-le-Vicomte, it's in Alexandre Dumas. And he never actually beats the hold of the financiers, what would now be called the trust fund monopolists and so on French finances. They're partly privatised with catastrophic results. All these issues are still alive today.
Mm. And now a dreadful question we've raised. If you could, Louis in a sentence, or is that appalling?
He adored gardens. He went out round the garden of Versailles, changing things, giving orders. Even in the coldest month of the year, even when he's 70, January, he was going out at a time when everything was frozen, and even his beloved dogs, whose portraits he would commission, wouldn't go out into the garden. It was too cold for them. So I would say he was the toughest animal in his own court.
Okay, Louis XIV the gardener, who would have thought it? Thank you very much, Philip, for joining us.